Some years ago, I preached a sermon here on some aspects of the relationship between science and the Bible. And sometime afterwards then, my children would refer to it as Daddy's Science Sermon. And that was okay. But then other times they would refer to that as Daddy's sermon that wasn't from the Bible. And that was a little more disconcerting for me when they referred to it in that way. Well, this morning I'm preaching what you might call another science sermon. And so I want to make clear at the outset that it is from the Bible. Okay? So my text for this morning is Romans chapter 1 and verse 20. Romans 1 and verse 20, where Paul tells us that God's invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. So we have sung from Psalm 19, we've read Psalm 104 as other parts of Scripture that teach this truth that God reveals himself in his creation, in the world around us. Paul here in Romans 1:20 specifies two truths about God, doesn't he? His eternality and his power. He says that his eternal power has been made known. But he also then says that there's a lot else made known in creation about God. Because he adds, not only is it God's eternal power, but his divine nature, the other aspects of God made known then in creation. And so this morning I want to draw out 10 truths that are revealed about God from creation. When I said that to my wife last night, she was a bit fearful about how long this sermon might last. But don't worry, several of them will be quite quick and your meal won't burn in the oven. So we should be through this in good time. So 10 truths, and I've grouped them into two clusters or two groups. A first set of 5 truths that we might say teach us about the otherness of God, or the exaltedness, the sheer greatness and majesty of God. And then 5 truths that teach us more about his personality, about the kind of person God is. So first then, 5 attributes or 5 truths about God that relate to his exaltedness, his greatness. Now, scientists looking at the world describe it in different ways, but often talk then about the laws of science or the laws of nature, don't they? And as I've mentioned before then, that these are better described, of course, as God's laws. And when I've said, and when other people say, that the laws of science are really God's laws, I don't mean this in some kind of metaphorical way. I don't mean it to say that they're like laws, as if the real laws, as it were, are in the Bible. We're, of course, used to laws of God in the Bible, aren't we? We have lots of laws in Scripture, moral laws, civil laws, and so on. We're used to the fact that God is a law-giving God. But God has his laws all around us by which he governs creation, doesn't he? He's the great king. And as we've been reading in the Psalms and so on, he issues his commands and creation obeys. God rules his creation by his laws. He commands, he issues forth his laws to tell creation what to do, and creation does what God tells it to do. Creation obeys the laws of God. This isn't some kind of weak metaphor when we talk about the laws of God. This is completely real. This is the way in which God governs his universe. And when we think then on the laws as we discover them by scientific investigation, which are really God's laws by which he rules his universe, and science is about understanding God's laws and the way he runs his universe, when we do this, then we discover lots of wonderful truths about God. Because we see that God's laws, of course, apply everywhere. They're not unique to Newcastle or to Britain. Maxwell's equations, Newton's laws of motion, Einstein's relativity, whatever laws you can think of, they apply everywhere in the universe, not just here or not just on planet Earth. Gravity and so on applies throughout the universe. Because God, then, this shows us, is present everywhere, commanding and ruling in the universe. And God's laws are not only, of course, present everywhere, they are there from eternity or from the beginning through all time, aren't they? When Newton discovered gravity and developed the equations and so on, it wasn't just as if gravity had begun. Gravity had been there from the beginning. Gravity remains now and will be forever. As will the laws of optics. As will Boyle's laws of gases. All the laws of science are forever and ever. Because God is forever and ever. Remember, that's one of the things Paul states clearly in Romans 1:20. The eternal nature of God is declared then in this way in creation, isn't it? God's laws are everywhere at all times because God is present everywhere and at all times. He is omnipresent, he is eternal. And of course, God is unchanging. And again, his laws then show this is so, don't they? The laws as they were discovered centuries ago or millennia ago remain the same. This is why science can be done at all, isn't it? Science wouldn't work. We couldn't look at and learn all sorts of wonderful things from creation if it were not the case that everything remains the same. That the laws of God hundreds of years ago remain the same now, and they will through eternity. Because God, then, this teaches us, is an unchangeable God. His laws are unchangeable because they reflect his character, his immutable or unchangeable character. And then, of course, these laws reveal the power of God. Again, this is something the Apostle Paul makes explicit, isn't it? That they reveal the power of God. That everywhere, then, in the universe that we can go and explore to the furthest depths, in the furthest galaxies, the laws of God are in operation. And what powers them? What enables gravity to happen? What keeps nuclei together in atoms? It's the power of God. Strong and weak nuclear forces, electromagnetism, gravity, the fundamental laws of the universe are God's laws. Or should say, the fundamental constants of the universe and nature are God's. He powers all of these. And because he's doing this at all times, in all places, then this shows how amazingly powerful God is. That he is, in theological language again, the omnipotent God. He is omnipresent, he is eternal, he is immutable or unchangeable, he is omnipotent, and it is all shown us by these laws of God in creation. And none of what I've said here is at all original. None of what I'll say in this sermon is at all original. Scientists, secular scientists, write these things. But they also recognise that the fact of these laws doesn't mean that God is identical to the laws. That there must be something outside, some lawgiver, some being, some agent who sends them forth. Who, as the Bible says, speaks them forth. God commands and creation obeys, is the language of Scripture, isn't it? And that's because God is not part of, or just part of, or just within creation. He rules over creation from the outside, doesn't he? Or again, in theological language, he is transcendent over and above creation. He is the God who speaks from outside, commanding creation, issuing forth his laws, so creation does his bidding. The transcendent God, then, who is omnipotent, omnipresent, eternal, and unchangeable. These five truths are clearly declared in creation and in the laws we describe as often the laws of nature or science, but are really God's laws by which he rules his universe. But we just pause at this moment and remember what Paul also says here in Romans 1. He says in verses 18 and 19 that the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. What can be known about God is plain because God has shown it to them. And then he says what we read earlier, doesn't he? God's invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly perceived. Men, he says, are without excuse. But men suppress the truth. So I read these books of science. I read famous scientists and not so famous scientists saying everything I've just said to you. And do they fall down in worship? No. Do they conclude when they see the eternal power of God in creation that here is a God to be served and obeyed? No, sadly, most of them don't, do they? They suppress the truth. God makes it known so clearly to everyone that scientists, atheists, secular scientists, some of whom I'll be quoting shortly, recognize all these things. At one level, they kind of know it, but it doesn't lead to faith. It doesn't lead to worship. It should do. We gather to worship God. We've been praising him this morning in our hymns and so on for the greatness he reveals in creation. But the sad truth is that men and women suppress these truths. The fact that it's also clearly made known sadly doesn't lead, as Paul says, people to worship. It just leaves them without excuse. Are you without excuse, as it were, this morning? Are you under the wrath of God still? God speak clearly to you of his divine and eternal power and so on. You need to bow and worship this great God through Jesus Christ, our Saviour. So five truths then about God's greatness or exaltedness. Well then, a little more slowly, five truths about God's personality. What kind of God is he? What kind of person is he? Well, the first thing is God shows that he is a personal God in creation. Because we see this in the rationality of creation, don't we? Creation is rational. That's why we can do science. That's why these laws are there. They show God is rational. We can think. We can investigate. We can reason from creation. We can draw rational conclusions. Paul Davis was a professor of physics, and I think he was at Newcastle University at one point, and then at various other places in London and so on. He's written several books, but in his book, The Mind of God, secular scientist Paul Davis wrote, "Scientists themselves normally take it for granted that we live in a rational, ordered cosmos, subject to precise laws that can be covered by that can be uncovered by human reasoning. Yet why this should be so remains a tantalizing mystery. Why should human beings have the ability to discover and understand the principles on which the universe is run? So it's seen and not seen." Now, of course, we think, who are Christians, we say, well, of course, we know why it's so, don't we? Because God is rational. That's why the universe makes sense. That's why we can investigate it. The most famous quote in this regard is from Albert Einstein, of course. Albert Einstein declared that the most incomprehensible thing about the world is that it is comprehensible. The most incomprehensible thing about the world is that it is comprehensible. Why then, you see, why is it that if it's true that everything's happened in a kind of chaotic, random way, if the universe has developed in an unguided, blind way, if there's an evolutionary process that is blind and random, how can we end up with rationality at the end of it? How can we end up with an ordered, rational universe? And how can we be rational beings who can investigate it? We know the answer because, of course, the Lord who made the universe is the God who made us, and he's a God who is rational. The physicist Eugene Wigner wrote a paper entitled "The Unreasonable Effectiveness of Mathematics in the Natural Sciences," in which he wrote, "The first point is the enormous usefulness of mathematics in the natural sciences is something bordering on the mysterious. There's no rational explanation of it. It's not at all natural that the laws of nature should exist, much less that man should be able to discover them. It's not just we can think about the universe. It's not just that the universe is intelligible. It's the fact that we in our heads can conjure up mathematical equations and they actually work in the world out there. Why should this be so? Why should maths work so fantastically well? Why should we conjure up things that would seem to be entirely of our own imagination, and yet it works in describing so accurately the universe that God has made? It's mysterious," says Wigner, "that maths should work so wonderfully well. But it does, because God is rational, the reasonable, rational God who made us and made the universe. That's why, of course, it all works so well. That's why mathematics is so fantastic, a way of investigating God's universe." Or just to change tack quickly, I'm going to skip everything I was going to say on chemistry here. Sorry to the chemists amongst you. Biology, DNA, isn't that amazing? Now, you know, or some of you may know, that NASA, American Space Agency, is again planning trips to the moon in about 10 years, and beyond that, they're using that as a staging post to go to Mars. And we all know why they want to go to Mars. They hope that if they land on Mars, they're going to find some rocks, and somewhere on those rocks or tablets, they're going to find writing, or they're going to find some set of symbols, and then everybody will be jumping up and down and saying, "Isn't it fantastic there was intelligent life on Mars?" And yet in the mid-20th century, of course, when we find code in our cells, in the cells of every living being, the genetic code in DNA, then the world wasn't jumping up and down and saying, "Wow, there must be a fantastic intelligence that put it there." But of course, that's the case, isn't it? The genetic code is such a powerful testimony to the rational God who's put that coded information in every living creature. God is rational. He declares his rational nature. And of course, it's only intelligent personal beings who are rational. Only personal beings reason, think. God is personal. It's shown in his rationality through creation. It's also relatedly shown in beauty. The beauty of creation. The beauty then of scientific formulae. Most well known must be E equals MC squared. 5 digits. That so concisely, so beautifully capture something so complex and amazing. And lots of other scientific equations are like that, aren't they? F equals ma, other Newton's laws of motion things. They're just described so concisely, so beautifully. You think, wow, how can that be? Paul Davis, again, the physicist or astrophysicist, wrote, "It's widely believed among scientists that beauty is a reliable guide to truth." That may surprise you. It's widely believed among scientists that beauty is a reliable guide to truth, and many advances in theoretical physics have been made by the theorist demanding mathematical elegance in a new theory. And he goes on to quote how Einstein, when he was developing his theories, wanted to find the most beautiful equations. He went about doing his science by looking for beauty. Or the theoretical physicist Paul Dirac, who developed the theory of antimatter and the equations of antimatter, wrote, "It's more important to have beauty in one's equations than to have them fit the experiment. He wants the maths to look so beautiful, and then he knows that maths will be right. And the first experiments didn't support his equations, but then all the experiments later did support his equations, and he believed they were right because they were the most beautiful equations that he could develop. Maths is full of amazing beauty. Now, I know many of you will be perplexed by this. You can't understand why mathematics should be beautiful at all. But it is, if you understand it. And people here will tell you that that is so, I'm sure. There's lots of other beauty, though, in creation. If I said the beauty of creation, most of you, of course, would have thought of like what we were singing earlier on, in all things bright and beautiful, wouldn't you? The purple-headed mountains, the rivers flowing, and so on. And that's right. God's beauty is revealed in these ways. It's revealed in the amazing movements of the heavenly bodies above. It's revealed, as we've sung, in those beautiful sunsets lighting up the sky, and so on. God's beauty revealed in creation. Creation is full of beauty because creation was made by a beautiful God. Now, related then to the beauty of God is that it's not just in mathematics, it's not just in the equations of mathematics, but it's in all aspects of science. Science, whether it's chemistry, maths, physics, geology, whatever, reveals the beauty of God. Some of you may have heard of Stephen Jay Gould. Stephen Jay Gould was one of the most prominent evolutionary scientists in the world in the 20th century. He had many arguments with Richard Dawkins. They were both ardent evolutionists who disagreed on how evolution is supposed to work. In his book, The Structure of Evolutionary Theory, Gould wrote, "Hardly a scientist, dead or alive, has ever failed to locate his chief delight in the lovely puzzles, the enchanting beauty, and the amazing complexity of organisms in real places. We became scientists because we loved those dinosaurs in the museums. We scrambled after those beetles in our backyards, or we smelled the flowers of 100 particular delights. And something unspeakably holy, I don't know how else to say this, underlies our discovery and confirmation of the details of our world." Gould, ardent atheist, something unspeakably holy and delightful in the creation that the Lord has made. Creation is beautiful because God is beautiful. And then creation also declares the extravagance of God. God's amazing generosity or extravagance. Some years ago, we were doing some decorating at home, and we had this room, and we had a couple of very large wardrobes, and of course, they were packed full of stuff. And we thought, well, do we unload all those wardrobes and move them and then paint behind the wardrobes, and then we'll put them back again, and nobody will ever see what we've painted, will they? What's the point? Well, God paints behind the wardrobes. God paints behind the wardrobes, doesn't he? Because he fills his creation with all sorts of amazing things that no one ever sees. You think of snowflakes. Each snowflake, as you know, is its unique, beautiful hexagonal pattern. Millions, billions of snowflakes created by God, and yet most of them must fall and melt and never be seen by anyone at all. What a waste. Why go to the effort of making such beautiful snowflakes and nobody ever sees them? Because God is extravagant, isn't he? Many of you will have watched David Attenborough's various series, and in The Blue Planet, some of you may have seen then, where they sent these immersibles into the great depths of the oceans. And down there in the great depths of the oceans, they found all these weird and wonderful creatures, didn't they? Creatures that had never been seen by human eyes before. creatures that have existed there for ages, entirely unknown and unseen. These amazing, beautiful creatures, unknown to human beings until those immersibles went into the depths. God made them. He placed them there, unseen. Or you take the stars in the sky. Everybody always loves the stars in the sky. We look up and down the ages, people have enjoyed looking up into the cosmos and the amazing patterns of the stars in the sky and describing the different formations and so on. And then we develop telescopes and we look beyond and we see that the vast numbers of stars that we can see beyond them, unseeable by human eyes, are huge numbers more stars. And then we develop even more powerful telescopes and we look even further afield and we see even more amazing stars. And we get the Hubble Deep Space Telescope and it probes into vast distances into the universe and reveals these fantastic nebulae and these amazing star formations, unknown for ages. Unknown, of course, only by human beings, known to God, who placed them there. All these things because God is an extravagant, generous God, isn't he? I mentioned this to William a few weeks ago about the generosity, the amazing abundance of God in creation. It tells us something about his generous, wonderful character, doesn't it? He's an extravagant God. And I said this to William and he said, "Oh, fractals. Fractals," he said. Fractals. And I'd heard of fractals. I knew a bit about fractals. So fractals is basically a new area of mathematics. Because what I didn't know and what William told me was that fractals had only been discovered in the last 50 years. Now, again, you don't know anything about mathematics. You might find it odd that you can discover new things in mathematics. But you can. You can discover all sorts of fantastic new things in maths. And fractals, then, are these wonderful equations that describe beautiful patterns. Completely unknown again until recently, because God paints behind the wardrobes. He is an amazingly abundant and generous God. If it was us, we wouldn't waste time, would we? We wouldn't bother creating all these things that no one would ever see. So I don't think you can deduce from creation the grace of God. We can't deduce grace from creation. To understand God as gracious, we need to understand sin and we need to understand salvation and all that means. But on the other hand, if God was Scrooge-like, if God were a kind of miserly God who just made enough snowflakes that human beings could see and didn't have then vast stars unknown in the universe and so on. If God were miserly, then it's very difficult to see how he would ever be gracious, isn't it? But God is an extravagant God, and it's to me, I think, entirely consistent with the generosity and the extravagance of God, the almost wastefulness of God in his creation, that he is gracious. Takes special revelation to teach us that he's gracious, but it's consistent there with his generosity, his extravagance in creation. And related then to the extravagance of God, then is the joy of God, the joyfulness of God. So we know God is joyful. Again, we've seen this declared through creation. And we've seen it declared in what we've just been thinking about, haven't we? Why should God create all those snowflakes that nobody ever sees? Why should God put all those galaxies that we've only just discovered? Why should God make those marvellous creatures in the depths of the ocean unknown till very recently and so on? Well, surely the only answer is it pleased him to do so. He enjoyed it. We create things sometimes, ourselves, don't we? We human beings make works of art, carve a sculpture, compose a piece of music. And people who do that will say their pleasure is in the act of creation. It was composing the piece of music. It was painting that picture. They enjoyed it. They're not so bothered if nobody else ever sees it. It's a work of art, and they enjoy producing it. Certainly God enjoys then, I think, producing all these things in creation. He enjoys it. That's why he does it. It's so extravagant and unnecessary. They serve no purpose. But they show us that God is a God who enjoys his creation, enjoys making all these wonderful things. Again, in those David Attenborough things, you'll have seen those dolphins swimming through the oceans. You might have seen those pictures then of those dolphins frolicking around, playing with bits of seaweed or something and tossing them around and crying out to each other. And David Attenborough intoning very seriously that we don't really know why they do this. They just seem to be enjoying themselves. And that might well be true. Even if it isn't true and we find a reason, it still reflects the joyfulness of God. But some things just to speak that God likes making things that are good and enjoyable. And that we can enjoy. Think of birdsong. Again, birds then, yeah, birds have specific cries or calls that are purposeful to warn about predators and mating calls and things. But birdsong is different. The singing of birds seems to serve no purpose. Yet we have then the joys of the morning chorus, don't we? You're lying in bed, you hear those birds singing outside. You hear many birds singing, this lovely sound in the morning, this beautiful music. It doesn't seem to serve any purpose, we're told. But it's joyful, isn't it? Because God is a God of joy. And he fills his creation with beautiful things, an abundance of beautiful things, an abundance then that shows forth, I think, that he is a joyful God. And then finally, tenthly, if you've been keeping notes and keeping up, tenthly, then we have the wisdom of God. God's wisdom declared in creation. And again, I think we're very familiar with the fact that God declares what a wise God he is, how well he rules his universe. It's in the book of Proverbs in particular, isn't it, that we should learn of the wisdom of God through studying his creation. We think then of the movements of those heavenly bodies, so many of them moving around constantly, the planet circulating the sun moving through our galaxy, the Milky Way, our galaxy moving past all these other galaxies and so on. All sorts, millions and billions of heavenly bodies moving around, all governed so wisely by God. Or again, dropping to the cellular level again. The intelligent design movement has enjoyed showing us the intricacy of God's creation, pointing out all the amazing molecular machines in every cell. Every cell in your body filled with these fantastically complex, beautifully created machines that run our cells, declaring the intelligence, the wisdom of God in his creation. And then there's what scientists call the anthropic principle. From the Greek anthropos or anthropos, meaning man or human being. And this means that scientists are amazed at the way in which the universe, as they would put it, seems to have been designed for human life. The anthropic principle is the way that so many of the laws of science and the constants in science, and the way the universe is set up, is just perfectly set up so that human life exists. Were things just a little bit different, human life wouldn't exist at all. And there are many, many examples of this. Again, Paul Davies, the scientist I've mentioned, the physicist, he's written a book called The Goldilocks Enigma. Because the universe, if things were a little bit bigger or a little bit smaller, we wouldn't exist. But everything is just right. The Goldilocks principle. Or what is sometimes called the fine-tuning of the universe. Everything is just right. Some of it, a bit like what I was saying with beauty and joy in the Lord, is extravagance, is not, we think, necessary. So, for example, solar eclipses. So the sun has to be just the right size, and the moon just the right size, and they each have to be just the right distance from the Earth for solar eclipses to happen. It's incredible that it's so, but it is. That doesn't seem to serve any other purpose than to give us something weird and wonderful to enjoy. But lots of other things do. The distance of the Earth from the Sun has to be right. Too near, it will be frazzled by its heat. Too far away, it'll be too cold for life. The amount of oxygen in the atmosphere has to be just what it is. If it was a little bit more, the whole planet would be an inferno. If it was just a little bit less, the oxygen tension in cells wouldn't be enough for cells to live. If gravity were a little bit stronger, stars would collapse too much and they would burn up very quickly, and so the universe as we know wouldn't have developed. If gravity were a little bit weaker, stars wouldn't collapse at all to produce the nuclear fusion that produces all the energy that comes forth from the sun and all the stars. They have to be just right, all these things. Or perhaps my favourite at the moment is the exquisite balance between gravity and the weak nuclear force. Now there's forces holding all our atoms together. One of these is the so-called weak nuclear force. You won't have heard of that, many of you, but then there's gravity, which you will have heard of. Gravity acts over vast distances in the universe. The weak nuclear force acts over minute distances within atoms. But these two have to be exquisitely balanced for everything to exist. There's a lot more detail one could add. And scientists have sat down and worked out how balanced, how exquisitely fine-tuned the weak nuclear force and gravity have to be. And the answer is, if they were different by one part in 10 to the 60, life wouldn't exist. Now, for the non-mathematicians among you, 10 to 60 is often a very, very big number. So that's 1 followed by 60 zeros. So 1 followed by 6 zeros is a million, which is a big number, and that would be pretty impressive, wouldn't it? 1 in a million. But it's not 1 in a million. It's 1, not in 10 to the 60, but 1 in 10 to the 60. And there are all sorts of other ways, then, in which the universe is amazingly fine-tuned for human life to exist. And all of this, and then this so-called anthropic principle, shows forth the wisdom of God. He had balanced all this, all these forces, all the distances, all these factors in creation. He's balanced in just the right way. So the universe is set up in just the right way for human life and for us to enjoy then the universe that God has made. And for us then to learn, as we're doing this morning, truths about God. Truths then that should inspire us to worship this great God. So I've just derived 10 truths. There are other truths we can learn and enjoy from creation. We learn them and we enjoy because we worship this great Creator God.